KALW.
There was a major impact, and I still is, on the supply chain of really all technology. Same thing with hotspots.
San Francisco Unified is pushing to get all students online and learning.
Students may have sheltered in place with somebody else, with an aunt, with an uncle, with a family friend.
We'll hear why getting families connected with computers and internet access in the age of COVID-19 is complicated. Then we talk to body image activist Virgie Tovar about the new hidden messaging to teenage girls.
They decided to make WW stand for something like wellness within.
And we'll continue our series featuring new releases by local authors.
The darkness, the slow crawl, the crooked wind-up energy of night was us.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. For San Francisco Unified students, interactive online learning rolled out on April 13th. That's about 3 weeks ago. That's when teachers started logging on to meet with kids and assign work. Students now have access to Google Classroom, Zoom chats, and all kind of other online platforms. But schools had been closed for a whole month before that. So why did it take so long? KALW's education reporter Lee Romney explains.
The first thing you should know, San Francisco educators were not taking a break in those first weeks after schools closed down. A lot of them, like dance teacher Shona Mitchell.
Hi, dancers.
Were uploading videos to easy-to-use websites.
Stuck at home, I thought I would share some videos with you so you can dance and move and just get your wiggles out while you're stuck at home for these few weeks.
Like Ms. Mitchell, who teaches at several SFUSD elementary schools, most teachers were providing optional resources to help kids cope with being cooped up.
You start with the seed deep in the ground.
And you guessed it, back in March when she uploaded the video, San Francisco schools were only expected to be closed for 3 weeks.
Please stay healthy, stay safe, wash your hands, and I will see you in April.
Not quite. But there's another reason why those early weeks were all about low-pressure, voluntary read-alongs and breathing exercises.
The exacerbation of existing inequities that we're feeling each and every day.
Melissa Dodd is San Francisco Unified's chief technology officer, in charge of all data systems, devices, and more. Dodd didn't have accurate data yet, but the district knew that plenty of kids didn't have the computers and internet access they needed to learn online. Rolling out full-on distance learning assignments when only more affluent students could participate, the district decided, would only deepen the achievement gap. The first hitch? Figuring out how many students needed devices.
Based on older data and definitely incomplete data, you know, we had assumed that it was around the 14% mark. The need is much higher than that.
We now know that at least a fourth of students in 3rd through 12th grades, which the district is prioritizing for tech, needed home computers, and at least a tenth needed help with internet access. But there was no way to get a handle on those numbers without getting in touch with families. Cell phone numbers for the neediest families often go cold. Plus, Dodd says,
students may have sheltered in place with somebody else, with an aunt, with an uncle, with a family friend.
The task of tracking students down fell to teachers, social workers, and other staff. As schools launched those efforts, Dodd told principals to get back to their campuses and grab all the devices kids usually use in class only.
Break down your Chromebook carts. All of the chargers and wiring are all like embedded with the carts. When you loan out a device, student ID, give them the device.
By then, Dodd was pretty sure that those devices wouldn't stretch far enough. So she ordered more. Enter hitch number two.
There was a major impact, and I still is, on the supply chain of really all technology. Same thing with hotspots. Tried to get orders of hotspots in, and then similarly, hotspots aren't available.
Hotspots allow anyone in an area with cell phone service to access the internet. But in hilly San Francisco, they're not for everyone because Hitch number three.
Some neighborhoods and areas of our city don't have strong cellular service.
And plenty of families who had internet access didn't have good enough access or bandwidth for an interactive video chat. So the district teamed up with internet service providers and acquired super spots that can provide a bunch of connections at a time for single room occupancy hotels, homeless shelters, and some public housing developments. But gaps in access remain.
I do think the connectivity need is still high. This is a national challenge and, in my opinion, a national crisis.
Here's Jennifer Siebel Newsom, California's first partner.
50% of low-income families and 42% of families of color in California are worried about distance learning because they don't have a personal device at home.
Some wealthy districts in California launched interactive distance learning right out of the gate. Other districts are just getting started. And in rural areas, lots of students live where internet access just doesn't exist. Even within SFUSD, not all schools are having the same success helping families in need.
I went around with 5-6 different people.
Maria Aguilar Osejo has two boys. She says it took 3 visits to her fifth grader's elementary school to get a Chromebook, and she hasn't been able to reach his teacher with questions. Her experience has been much better with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Academic Middle School, which her older son, Javier, attends. They contacted her immediately, she says, got Javier a computer and Aguilar a hotspot, and even gave the family grocery gift cards, everything she says her son needs.
To be connected and be able to continue studying and educating himself.
Do you want to type or do you want me to type?
You type, please.
This is Javier having a one-on-one lesson with his 7th grade math teacher, Michael Johnson, on surface area.
Length.
Times
width. Perfect. That kind of coming back a little bit now?
Yes.
We talked about it a really long time ago, probably like 2 months ago. So.
The need is great. 3/4 of the students at Javier's school get free or reduced price lunch. That same ratio holds true for Cesar Chavez Elementary School. And at that campus, 85% of the 3rd through 5th graders have needed Chromebooks, and staff are continuing to reach out.
Via text or phone, since a lot of our families aren't connected with email.
That's Zareen Poonen-Levine, whose whole job is focused on digital learning.
Using technology to integrate with curriculum to kind of elevate the instruction.
Levine was part of a team at Cesar Chavez that started updating family contacts just before schools closed. For those families without devices and plenty still struggling to access the internet, though, Cesar Chavez started its own YouTube channel.
Since it is so widely available on smartphones.
Hola, amigos. Este libro se llama Pelitos, o en inglés, Hairs, por Sandra Cisneros.
That's Levine doing a read-along in one of more than 85 videos the school has posted so far.
Todos en nuestra familia tenemos pelo diferente.
As of last Friday, the district had loaned 12,100 Chromebooks and 2,900 hotspots to students in grades 3 through 12, and that effort is ongoing.
El pelo de mi papi es como una escoba.
I'm Lee Romney for Cross Currents.
Y yo, mi pelo es flojo. Nunca obedece a broches o diademas.
Lee is KALW's education reporter, and she's got some SFUSD tech resources. Check out her story online at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. For many teenagers, body image is a big issue, and it's not a new one, but it seems every generation faces new challenges. In my day, it may have been getting messages about body image from TV, movies, or magazines, but for today's teenage girls, Social media and the internet dominate the message of what it means to be pretty and what size is cute. At the same time, the internet era has seen seemingly healthy slogans like you be you and self-confidence and wellness movements. But my guest, Virgie Tovar, says it's still problematic, especially for teenage girls of color. Tovar is a renowned body image activist and author and a Latina. Her new book is called The Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Color. I called her up to chat, and she started by reading from her book.
There's a myth that girls don't understand their bodies and that you can't trust your body. The truth is that you know your body better than anyone on this planet ever will. This makes you an expert. Your body tells you when it likes something and when it doesn't. Your body tells you when it likes a person and when it doesn't. Your body knows when you're in danger and when you're safe. Listen to your body. It's giving you information all the time. Your job is to clear away as many obstacles as you possibly can so that you can hear all the messages and secrets it has for you.
People know you from your work in body image positivity, whether it's through reading your articles and writings. You know, in 2018, you were named one of the 50 most influential feminists by Bitch magazine. But going into the world of teenage girls and teenage girls of color at that, what made you want to talk to and about teenagers? And were you ready for this?
My foray into feminism started not long after I was a teenager. I was introduced to feminism when I was about 20 years old, and it really saved my life, essentially. And then I would go on to, you know, I learned anti-racism, I learned, you know, body image and body justice work after those things. And it just, again, there was such a power to having that education, and I wish that I had had it earlier.
You said when you were a child, you know, food was not seen as an evil at home. And when you went out into the world to school, that's where you saw diet culture. And I read an article that said you wanted your goal to be eliminating diet culture in your lifetime. I'm wondering, do you feel still that is a goal of yours? And how are you doing on that goal as you look around today?
Yes. I mean, I'm like, dream big, right? Why not have what you mean? It's like, go big or go home. I'm going to, like, that's going to be my mission statement. I'm going to keep it. So on the one hand, diet culture, the diet industry in particular, for a long time, relied primarily upon the vast majority of women in particular, because women are the disproportionate consumers of all diet products. It relied on the culture, but women in particular, never knowing that they could opt out. And so, you know, right, we're at a point in our history as a culture where we now have a wide scale movement that is telling people that they actually can opt out. This is what life could look like if they stopped doing that. And that literally did not exist 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, really, to, like, on any scale that was noticeable. And so I think that is a major win, right? The fact that they were relying upon utter ignorance, and that was the strategy, meant that it was very easy to topple what they were doing once you had democratized communication, which we got through social media. So I think, like, I'm in a lot of ways, right? Like, if you think of diet culture as like a table with four legs, that's one of the legs and it's gone. I think, you know, and they're scrambling to try and sort of get that leg back up through using all of this confusing dog whistle language, like shifting everything to wellness, shifting everything to, like, I love myself, shifting everything to co-opting body positive language to try and sell weight loss.
Can you talk about that just a little more, like these hidden,
like this hidden messaging. Again, I'm just thinking about teenage girls who, you know, take a message in a little capsule and run with it. What's happening there?
You know, we went from having no meaningful representation of anybody besides thin people, and again, primarily thin white people, thin young cisgender white people, right? And we now have this plethora of possibility, right? So fat people no longer see staying fat as a space that is completely impossible if they want dignity. So right, like that. That's a major shift. So diet culture, the diet industry picked up on the fact very quickly that this was kind of the new messaging, right? It began to get picked up like by all these different fashion companies and whatnot. And Weight Watchers is an interesting example of this messaging shift, right? So before Weight Watchers, I mean, it's in the name, right? It was very overtly about weight control and restriction. Yes. And controlling what you eat. Now, then they had the brand shift. They called it WW. They took the word weight out of it. They decided to make WW stand for something like wellness within. Mm-hmm. And then I started to see like GNC, the vitamin company, which had always been about fitness, always been about weight loss. They started changing their messaging to be something like, you know, essentially like it's on your terms, what you want to do, don't worry about your genes. It was like overnight it went from blatant fat phobia to you can love yourself and still be eating vitamins and going to the gym and doing this kind of thing, and we're going to call it wellness, we're going to call it being on your terms. Mm-hmm. We're going to say we don't want you to be on a diet because we now know the diets don't work, right? Like we want you to do something that actually will succeed. And what is that? A lifestyle change, right? And this is the same stuff where there's like literally no like that whole lifestyle thing has been a meme within diet world for so long. We learn who is beautiful and valuable from our culture. So it starts out with that very premise of like, you know, here is the thing that you inherited and here's what's wrong with it. And for me, I allowed my own experience of learning feminism, anti-racism, and body justice to inform how the work unfolded. But we go from like beauty standards to talking about the essentially like the way that a lot of girls of color face two really impossible standards. They face the white standard and they also face whatever their intra group standard is, and they're often entirely different bodies.
If there was one thing you could tell your younger self at, I don't know, age 12, 13, out of all the things you've learned and that you're teaching, what would it be?
I think I would want to tell my younger self that, I'd want to tell her that like she is good, that she is allowed to be vulnerable, that she is like in the midst of an onslaught of so many negative forces, that she is allowed to remember that she has a sacred humanity that transcends everything, and that she has an incredible power to take these experiences and turn them into something that are meaningful for her, and that like allow her to see like that she's this incredible, powerful, magical being.
Virgie Tovar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Virgie Tovar is a body image activist and author of the book, The Self-Love Revolution, Radical Body Positivity for Girls of Color. It came out May 1st. You can find more information about it at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. In addition to Virgie Tovar, countless Bay Area authors with spring book release dates have had to cancel their launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus. So we are bringing them to you in this series we're calling New Arrivals. Here's South Bay author Beth Lissick. Her book, called Edie on the Green Screen, came out in March.
It's about a middle-aged bartender in San Francisco struggling with the tech influx and the disappearing art scene. Here's a part from early in the book. She's at the bar opening up for her shift. There was a time when the bar and the people in it used to make me feel secret, like I had a clubhouse. For so long, I thought ambition, industry, the daylight, the day workers, the sun itself, all of it was them, the enemy. The darkness, the slow crawl, the crooked windup energy of night was us, our team. But that wasn't true anymore. As my team died out, moved up, moved on, morphed, I started to think I had been wrong all along. There was less and less proof that me and my team had been around at all.
That's author Beth Lissick. You can find more information about Edie on the Green Screen and other books by local authors released this spring. Go to KELW.org/newarrivals. Tune in tomorrow at 5. Community testing has been happening in San Francisco's Mission District. We'll hear about the results.
What we found is essentially shelter in place is working for those who can shelter in place. What the numbers we just released found, it was a little bit more maybe frustrating and maybe a little more painful than what I thought it would have been.
COVID-19 testing in the Mission tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Precious Green, Lisa Morehouse, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Sarah Lai Sterlin. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.